I'm going to open as a subcommittee and a public hearing on Senate Bill 5516. Rick, you're going to be the person who opens this.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Good morning. Good morning, subcommittee members. We have before you Senate Bill 5518. It's the budget bill for the Employment Department. I delivered to your offices on Friday a packet of material with a cover memo. I hope you got that and had an opportunity to look at it. If you don't have that, I've got a couple extra copies if you need them. Just real briefly, the Employment Department is funded primarily through other funds and federal funds. It does have a relatively small amount of general fund, $3.6 million in the governor's budget. The general fund is used for the child care program of the department. I'm sure the department will go into that in more detail in their presentation. There were 8 budget notes contained in the last budget for this agency. The department has included in their budget presentation binders on pages A29 through A31 a description of those 8 budget notes and their responses to them. There was a change of director audit that was completed by the Secretary of State's Audit Division in September of 2002. I've attached a summary of that audit report to the handout that I distributed to your offices. Additionally, during the interim, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee conducted a review of the hearing officer panel. I've also included a copy of the executive summary from that report attached to the email or the memo as well. There are no fee adjustments proposed for the department in this budget. The department did appear to the emergency board a few times during the interim to request increased limitation and the establishment of limited duration positions as the workload for the department fluctuates, and especially during the last biennium as the economy has fluctuated and the economic recession and the high unemployment has caused the department to experience a workload increase, and those issues were addressed during the emergency board meetings. Again, the current state of the economy is a concern, specifically as it relates to the workload for the Employment Department, and I'm sure they will address that issue as well. And unless there's any questions, that's all I have at this point.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll go ahead and ask Deborah Lincoln to come on up. Deborah, anyone coming with you at this time?
Mr. Chairman, Satish Upadhyay from DAS will come up at this time, and we'll bring some of the other program directors up as we get to that.
You heard the request as far as letting us know what page or what book you're in.
Yes, I did.
With that, we'll let you go ahead and get started.
Mr. Chairman, we have put in front of you a handout that looks like this. What we've done, I'm sorry, my name is Deborah Lincoln, Director of the Employment Department. We have put in this handout responses to the 4 questions that the co-chair asked us specifically to address. So we can go through this and address those 4 questions and then get into more program detail, whatever is your pleasure.
That sounds good.
Okay, the handout then, page 1, starts with the personnel issues. We get into then prioritize list of services, performance measures, and comparisons with other states. Personnel issues, we've got vacancies on page 1. You'll see that we started out at the end of December with 147 vacancies. Currently, we have about 78. 3 of those are due to the general fund increase, and those, as Rick mentioned, are in the child care division. Most of those 78 vacancies are being recruited for right now. Others are being used to support job rotations and temporary positions, mostly for succession planning. We're looking at about over about 27% of our employees able to retire by the end of this year. So we're doing quite a bit of succession planning and some training.
Just 1 second. I'm going to close it as a subcommittee and open as a full committee on Senate Bill 5516. Just 1 second. We are on this piece right here. And Thursday at 10. Thank you.
Thank you. Page 2 is a snapshot of the FTE and the positions that we have. We started out in the legislatively adopted budget from last year at 1,540 positions, 1,452 FTE. We are requesting in the governor's balanced budget a total of 1,400 FTE. Most a number of these are elimination of limited duration positions. What we do through the year, because we have a number of contracts with other agencies, Department of Human Services, County Corrections, and those kinds of programs for placement of their clients in jobs, is bring on limited duration positions to do those contracts, and then as those contracts come and go, we have the flexibility to adjust. So we've removed a number of those limited duration positions from the budget request, but down at the bottom, if you'll see the employment contracted services, we're asking for about half those back, again, to address those contracts. And we're looking at about 1,400 FTE then to go on into the coming biennium. On page 3, we look at the staff-to-management ratio. We've divided this out into executive management and staff. About 10% of our 0305 budget request is management and executive. The rest of it is staff. So we have about a 1 to 10 span of control. On page 4, then we get into prioritized services. As every agency director will be telling you, this is like choosing which child you like best. It's very difficult to prioritize these services. We have developed this list based on our mission. And our mission is to support employment, support business and promote employment. That is, we provide workforce solutions for businesses, and we help residents with their career transitions. It's very important to note that our mission is set up that way, in that order, because business is our primary customer, and what we do is to help businesses with their workforce needs. Based on that, we've developed our priority list. 5 of these 7 programs are mandated by the federal government. If we don't do these, the programs that are mandated and stay in conformity with the government's, federal government's requirements, the federal government can increase employer taxes by 5 times. So it's very, very important to understand that eliminating any of these programs would be a difficult exercise. That's about all I'm going to say. You will hear about these individual programs as the program directors come up to go through their performance measures. So unless you have any.
Senator Dukes?
Which 2 are not federally mandated?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, number 2, child care, and number 7, the contested hearings panel are the 2 programs that are state. The child care piece is federally funded. There's a child care development block grant. That supports that program. The performance measures on page 5, we start with the measures that have been approved by the progress board. We have spend a lot of time addressing performance and understanding how it is we do. The federal government particularly requires us to do an awful lot of record keeping and performance measurement. The unemployment program itself has probably a couple dozen measures that we track for the federal government. The Office of Management and Budget is also developing performance measures for workforce agencies and the Workforce Investment Act has its own performance measures. So we have a number of measures to choose from. We originally selected 22 measures to represent our activities. As we worked with the Progress Board, we reduced that number to the 14 that you see in our submission here, and the Progress Board accepted them all during the final review process. Of the seven performance measures that we excluded, four were employment service measures that we will replace after June 2003, and three were child care measures that we'll be using in the next go-round. We're also looking at some measures for our research section that we'll add to the list next year. The measures themselves, very quickly, the first four measures regarding employment service are new. Again, we're working with the federal government. They are developing new performance measures. Further on, when we get into that program area, we'll give you some of the ones we've been working with in the past to give you a sense of what our what we have been doing. But as we go forward, we'll be using these the entered employment, employment retention, employer satisfaction, and job seeker satisfaction, which the federal government is asking us to develop.
Mm-hmm. When you give us that, could you also give us the exact benchmarks? I see where they're kind of listed here, but not in something that I understand. So.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I don't know what employment dispersion is. So.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, that's a good point. I don't have all that right in front of me either,
that's
but we'll
okay.
try to pull it
you're
up.
You're
going to
be getting us something
the...
else. You're going to add this to it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Deborah, another question I would have is there any way to quantify the impact of all the private folks that are out here doing parallel things? You know, you can go on Yahoo, you can go on so-and-so as far as job seeking and job placement and search and stuff like that. Most of the people I talk to, that's where they go now.
Mr. Chairman, we do keep an eye on that kind of thing. We don't want to compete with the private sector, obviously, and we work very closely with placement agencies and staffing agencies so that we don't interfere with their niche and we can fill in the gaps that they leave. No, the answer to your question is no. I don't have any quantification for what Yahoo and Monster.com and some of the other private entities get into. Let me see if we've got something that I can bring back to you on that.
Now that you've gone there, don't we have some companies that only list with us?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, yes, we've got a number of companies who prefer to work directly with us. Obviously, we don't charge. They've already paid for that service with their employment taxes. They find our services more conducive to the kinds of people they hire and the kinds of jobs they have. We have universal access. We take anyone who needs to look for a job so that we have a broader pool. But we do have some folks who will only work with us because they like our services and they like our staff. They've got a relationship with us. And then there are some companies who will only work with staffing agencies as well. So it's a it's a mix.
Are all state jobs listed only through the employment division? I mean, I know the individual agencies go out and put up their flyers and things, but I mean, it's on the way up. Are they all listed only through the employment division?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we do list them, and they do advertise in newspapers and particularly in bilingual media, but they don't work through staffing agencies.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. Following up on your question, throughout our discussion, would it be possible for me to get a list of those public partners you have that you're working with, and specifically how you're working with economic and community development, how you're working with the Small Business Development Center, how you're working with Department of Corrections, how you're working with OIA, et cetera, and the roles you play with those?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we'd be glad to do that. There's in the book you have in front of you, There is some information on that, and we'll get to that as we go through our program. We do work with all those folks. The Workforce Investment Act, the federal act, has something like 17 mandatory partners that we work with in one-stop centers. That includes vocational rehabilitation, the TANF folks, and all the folks that you mentioned, as well as some others. So, yes, we work very closely. Usually what we do is the placement of job-ready people for those folks. So we have a contract, for example, with Washington County to work with prisoners who are coming out of jail to get jobs. We've got two or three of those corrections contracts. We work with pretty closely with Voc Rehab, particularly because they are a job placement kind of a service for the disabled. So they do the intensive services and arrange for the training, and then we do the placement for their staff or for their clients. So we work with an awful lot of those folks, and we'll get you a full list of our partners for tomorrow.
Just an observation. I can't remember if Representative Hansen and I served on this committee last. I served on this committee last session. Were you on this committee as well? I really believe there's an opportunity for us as a committee to look at the way this department partners with some of these other agencies and departments, and there's ways for us to truly maximize the work they do. And during the interim, I thought a lot about this, and I hope it'll be okay as opportunities arise to share those with you as we go through this large budget. Thank you.
Remember one thing, too. You mentioned something a minute ago that keyed a thought in my mind, and that is, do we check to see whether or not the person that we're helping is, in fact, a legal resident?
Mr. Chairman, we do. Anybody who is legal to work in this state can have access to our services. If that person is here illegally, then no, we do not serve that person.
We have a set of criteria that we can look at, the things that you require?
Mr. Chairman, I'll bring that with us tomorrow.
Great. Thanks.
Do they have a card? If they're not U.S. citizens, don't they have to have a card?
They need a card.
That's all.
Ready? On page 6, we get into the unemployment insurance measures. Again, a lot of these are driven by the federal government. First payment timeliness, non-monetary separations, and again, the program director will be up here to give you any more detail that you need about on these. And we've got graphs and statistics back further in the presentation. On page 7, the lower authority appeals timeliness, those two measures address the hearings panel's responsibility. Higher authority appeals timeliness is the Employment Relations Board. And then on page 8, we get into the timeliness of employer tax payments. We do oversee the UI tax collection process. And the child care health and safety reviews address our child care division's responsibilities. On page 9, give you a little bit of an idea of where we get our information. As you can see, the Department of Labor is very much involved with us in ensuring that the work we do is satisfactory and up to snuff.
Deborah, before you go any further, I had a question on what Rick presented to us, and that was the last paragraph Rick gave us this. And the federal funding levels for administration of the unemployment insurance program have not been sufficient to cover the costs for many years. Are we running top heavy, or are they just sending an inadequate amount of money to all states?
Mr. Chairman, they send an inadequate amount of money for all states. My national organization just surveyed the states based on the president's budget coming out, and across the country, it's $400 million short of being able to support the UI and employment service programs. Employment services has been flat funded for over 10 years, which means no inflation, no cost of living increases. So our employment services support, which comes out of the Wagner-Peiser Act, only supports about a third of our employment services. We have a fund that the legislature set up in the early 90s, CDEF, which we'll talk about in a little bit, that supports the rest of that. And unemployment insurance money, too, doesn't
come in at the level that we need. We do a little bit better than other states. We get about 70 cents on the dollar back over the years. Other states get 30 or 40 cents on the dollar back for what they send in taxes. But it still isn't adequate to support our full administrative costs, and that's why that CDEF fund is so very important.
With the benchmarks, I didn't want to leave without seeing how we measured against other states, or are they all deficient? Senator Morris.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Debbie, will we see an accounts receivable age analysis in any of this data that we're looking at?
Senator Morris, we don't have it in here, but we can certainly bring that back to you tomorrow.
Just curious, the 92.2%, that's the 2000 value, where that now stands in collections and how far extended
sure.
they are.
Sure. Yes, we can bring that back to you tomorrow morning.
Thank you.
Senator Dukes.
Back to the not understanding the nomenclature. There's a goal here that says non-monetary, non-separations, timeliness. Percent of claims which are unrelated to job separation that are adjudicated within 14 days of the issue detection. I'm assuming these must be difficult ones because we're only at 67%. What is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes.
Page six,
yes. They are a little bit difficult, and if I could ask if we could put that off until Tom Barley gets up here. He can explain that in a lot better detail than I can explain it. Thank you.
Mr. Palmer.
You would like to follow up on hers. How about I recognize Senator Carter?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think that is very important information because it tells us, in terms of the high incidences of unemployment in our state, mm-hmm. when you look at rural counties and urban counties that had been hit hardest in our state, and you had structural unemployment. I'm speaking to the structural piece now, because when we, in 19, between 79 and 82, when we lost 79,000 foot of board lumber in the state, mm-hmm. rural Oregon was hit very hard, mm-hmm. and we did not start preparing programs until about 1985 mm-hmm. to try to deal with the skill level of those people. For instance, in urban Oregon, where we have very poor whites and very poor blacks, mm-hmm. we have not dealt with that. We have one piece in Northeast Portland, which is a skills center that helps those people develop those skills. And it's not big enough to take care of those issues. So when we look at structural unemployment, we look at the deficit spending in terms of them underfunding UI insurance. And then we look at what this layer now of unemployed, we still are not meeting the demands of being able to get people back into the marketplace, so therefore revenue sharing does not go across the board equally. And until we can get the unemployment, the employment division, or we can make some kind of decisions, since we're talking about economic opportunity in this state right now, to deal with the structurally unemployed, we're still missing the mark in terms of those people who are unemployed in this state. Mm-hmm. And so it would just appear to me that this piece that we're looking at right now has to take in consideration the structurally unemployed. Those people that have been out for more than for 10 years or more, because we have not done anything for that group. Mm-hmm. And that's an important piece if we're going to talk about economic development. And I'm going to hold all of you guys' feet to the fire on this one, even though I don't live in rural Oregon, but I will be a voice for those poor people who left the forest products industry and those poor whites and blacks in my community who haven't had opportunity, and all is going well in Oregon, and these people are unemployed and say, wait, what the hell is going on here? It's not going well for me. I still don't have food on the table. Mm-hmm. I mean, something is wrong with this picture. So if we're going to deal with it, let's just put it all on the table and let's deal with it. And that's the direction which I'm going. I'm going to hold all of you guys' feet to the fire on that one. Senator.
Senator Dukes and then Senator Morris.
Is that in here? Is there a goal for that?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, it's not in here. We, let's see.
there probably ought to be a goal for that.
Entered employment is certainly, and employment retention certainly deals with that. We work with our partners, again, under the Workforce Investment Act, to try to address those issues. And
you do a good job, I must admit, but if you don't get the money, then nothing you can do about it.
Hang on a minute, Margaret.
Okay.
We're supposed to be looking at evaluation, I mean, at performance evaluations,
right,
and at goals and guidelines to get us there. And now I've already admitted that I can't read half the goals and guidelines they've got because I don't understand the lingo. But it seems to me that there ought to be a performance measurement under what Senator Carter is talking about, so that we don't just deal with the people who got laid off 2 months mm-hmm. ago, mm-hmm. but we deal with the people who got laid off 10 years ago who would still like to work,
mm-hmm.
but we haven't quite got there yet.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, we do measure who gets into employment using our services and using our partner services, and that's and again, we have universal access, so that's anybody. It's not just unemployment claimants who are on the market right now. It's anybody who comes to us. We also track. You'll hear from Graham Slater, our research person. We track in detail what's going on with the economic situation in the state, the employment situation, and the kinds of information that we develop is key, I think, to developing the policies to get people back into to work. So we are very much involved in all that.
One of your goals is to reach out to those people, I take it. That's not one of your missions.
Madam Chairman, Senator Dukes, yes, it is. It's very much one of our mission. It's our mission is to support business and promote employment. The promote employment means everybody, very definitely.
Senator Boris?
I just wanted to follow up on my question with respect to the age analysis. The report that you'll be bringing will be for fees, fines, the entire spectrum, I hope. That would be my request.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, yes, we'll bring, we've got penalties and interest, fines, child care fees, as well as the taxes that we collect.
Right.
So
we can bring
all that.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. I think where we are now, Mr. Chairman, is we're ready to bring up the program directors to talk a little bit more in depth about their programs. If you'll turn to page 10, we start with the employment service piece. And Jan Dean is the assistant director for employment services, and she's going to walk you through those performance measures and tell you a little bit about her program at the time.
Welcome, Jan.
Good morning, for the record. I'm Jan Dean. I'm the director for the Employment Services Division. And I am looking at page 11 in your handout. Both page 11 and page 12 are representative of some of the historic performance measures that Debbie mentioned to you. The employment service program area is currently in transition from our historical set of performance measures to a new set. We have our historical measures were primarily counts or outputs, something that we frankly have very little control over in many ways. The economy affects it significantly. And as you look at the numbers on pages 11 and 12, please keep in mind that the peak of the employment and economic growth occurred in November of 2000. After that time, the employment numbers continued to decline each month until March 2002, when they hit the bottom. And since March 2002, employment growth has steadily, although slowly, improved. And so when I look at the number of hires, you can see how those program years track that economic information that I just shared with you, steadily rising until 2001, where they had a significant, about a 10,000 drop in the number of people that we actually placed in employer job openings, and then it is beginning to come back. Interestingly enough, for me at least, the obtained employments, which are people who that we help with what we call qualifying services, the federal government tracks services that we give to individuals who come into our offices. Many of them are not reportable, but those that are, we do keep a track of. Those kinds of services are things like job search activities. They include vocational guidance or testing. an enhanced enrollment, which would be a very complete historical occupational summary of that individual in our data bank system, an orientation to all of the services that would be available to them, job match, et cetera. And I found it interesting that it seemed to be the reverse of the economy. More people came in for services and found a job on their own within 90 days of working with the employment department, but it's kind of the inverse of our actual placement summary. And then if you look at the job orders, which are on your page 12, you'll see that, in fact, they, too, are tracking the job economy. You can see that it was slowing. Employment job orders from employers did hit a low in the program year 2001 and are beginning to slowly increase again now.
Why are you dropping the obtained employment?
Well, when I say we're dropping, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we will continue to track those. They are numbers that, frankly, the legislature and many of our constituents have been interested in for years, both how many placements we make, the hires, the job orders. So we will continue to monitor those. But because they are only outputs, they are not as far as the federal government and the Oregon Progress Board and others that we've worked with, because they're not a ratio, they are not as reflective of as our ability to be effective with the services that we provide. So the new ones will be similar, but they will be a ratio of individuals, you know, how many come in versus how many actually find a job, as I'll speak to in just a minute. But these raw numbers will still continue to be monitored.
The reason I'm interested in this one, and I'm sorry you're dropping it, is that you can give me your annual statistics, the number of people who come through your door, the number of people who've gotten a job, and that sounds good. But this is the number of people who've gotten a job within 90 days, I mean a shorter period of time. Mm-hmm. There are a certain number of people who will only come for a certain length of time, and I don't know after 3 months if they're still coming in. But I don't know. It seems to me that there's the press on, as long as you keep this statistic, there's the pressure on to produce more quickly. Not that you're not trying to. I think your agency does a great job.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I would be happy to be sure that we bring this back each time to share with you, because it is something we will continue to track.
Mm-hmm. Senator Carter.
I have to tell you, this is pre-editorial comment. I know of Debbie Lincoln's work, and I know that she will do a good job, so I'm not questioning your department. I'm questioning your partners. We lost, I think about $5 million was given to our youth center in Northeast Portland. And of that $5 million, I think the placement level was so low, it took about a year before they could come to grips with what was really happening. And a lot of young people between the ages of 16 and 21 have been unemployed now for about 2 years because of that. Those young people don't go to the employment division. They go to their partners for jobs. They would never be counted in this piece because they don't come to you. How do you make sure your partners are doing what they're supposed to do so those numbers can be counted? That's back to Senator Duke's question. That's back to my concern and my questions. When the agency is efficient, but they get these federal programs that are not run efficiently, and you don't get those numbers, period. And that's the part, that's what's happening with the structural unemployed in every last one of you guys' districts, where there are federal programs and the partners are not working to get people jobs. These people don't get the numbers. And so therefore, to me, it's never a true reflection of the numbers of unemployed in this state and the numbers of those that are still structurally unemployed. How do we get to that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I'm glad you raised that.
believe it or not. the group in your region, the Workforce Region 2, has undergone some change in the last year, partly because of that situation with the Youth Opportunity Center. They have a new director, Bob Vistos. Bob has been working very closely with me and Cam Preuss-Brawley, the Community College Commissioner, who oversees the Workforce Investment Act funding, to make big changes in that. He wants us to be partners with him, and we're going to take over as much of the placement in those areas as we can. We're also working to combine facilities so that we're all in one location, three or four locations that we're housed together around the Portland area. It's different in different regions. In Senator Duke's region, in Region 1, you can't tell the difference between the partners. What these partners are the former JTPA groups, the former PICs. That group and the employment department and the community college in Region 1 are practically interchangeable. They work so closely together and so well together. I'm trying to get away that.
And colleagues, the reason I'm saying that, because we supposedly combined JTPA and other federal and state programs together to have better efficiencies. And these efficiencies, as far as I'm concerned, have not come to total fruition. And I'm still having some problems with those since 1984. Okay? And that's the structural unemployment piece that I'm talking about and their effectiveness and what's been going on. Mr. Chairman, may I suggest to you that community colleges, those programs and those people come together and come before this committee, because I'm not sure whether skill centers, which is sponsored by, which is paid for by the state, and federal dollars come to skill centers in the state. And if they don't, then the community college presidents and all those people need to explain why it doesn't. Because somewhere along the line, if we're not going to have a holistic approach, you guys, I did not even think about all this stuff. It's just coming up in me right today. Unless we can have a holistic approach to dealing with unemployment in this area, you guys, communities in particular, the rural communities, are going to still wonder what is going on, why we have so much unemployment. And you're going to still be trying to explain why we don't. Well, we're not having the kind of efficiencies that we need to have. And somewhere along the line, if the community college isn't doing it, in terms of having explanations about successes, maybe the employment division needs to do that. But I tell you one thing, if you start checking your unemployment rate and you're wondering who's training whom and you're wondering why these people are not being trained, you might talk about greater efficiencies in these areas.
We're going to have to check for coffee after a while. This is very good. In fact, it brought me to my question, and then we'll go to Senator Morris. Do you have a question?
No.
And that is, how do we get accountability for that $5 million that the senator was talking about? I mean, what's the oversight? Is that directly in from the feds, and they're responsible for monitoring that? Or?
Mr. Chairman, that particular $5 million was directly in from the feds, and they did an audit, and they held it was Workforce Systems, Inc., as the organization, accountable for that. A lot of the workforce investment money, again, comes through the state, through the Community College and Workforce Development Department, and they audit. Sometimes with us, working with them, how those are expended. But the federal act doesn't give the state a whole lot of oversight on the formula funds that go out to them. That act is being reauthorized this summer, and a number of the states, both state and local levels, are concerned about how all that works, and so we're hoping we can get some changes in the federal reauthorization. You're right. The whole act as it was set up and envisioned hasn't gotten to the point where, as in Region 1, it's working so well. It's a region by region thing. There are still inefficiencies in some regions.
Deborah, is that something that we could get you to recommend a letter that we might write to our congressional delegation? And in fact, all of the.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be delighted to do that. Cam and I work very closely together on this. We can draft a letter for you. I'm going back to meet with my national organization, which is quite influential in this, at the end of February, and through them and directly to our delegation, I think we could have some input.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Senator Dukes?
I'm going to be a slow learner on this, as I can tell.
So it would have been the regional group that should have overseen that $5 million and how it was spent and should have expected more in the way of outcome from it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, yes.
In our relation to that regional group, we sit on the group, right?
Senator Dukes, we do have one representative on that board. The board consists of the mayor, a number of elected officials in Region 2, which is the metropolitan area, Multnomah, Washington, and a majority is business, has to be business on that board. So we have one representative on that board. So, yeah, we could raise those issues as well as any other board member.
Well, that's not where I was going. So there's... The group remains the same, it just has a different leader now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, yes, the hired staff leader, the executive director, has changed in the last 6 months.
Deborah, that brings a question for me.
I'm just muttering it. We're hoping that'll give us a different outcome. That sounds encouraging. It doesn't sound like anything I'd put my money on.
But that's a springboard to my question, and didn't see mention of the local community who have those students who are not being helped, that are not getting the jobs. Is there any representation of the local community?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there very definitely should be, and Senator Carter may know who's on that board, but I can bring a list of their board members back tomorrow if you'd like to see who's on.
They've asked for that come on the board, and so... I have to check my staff. I think I said yes, but I've got to double check that.
That would be very helpful.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, listening to all this and the transition of people from being unemployed to employed, I mean, that's what we want to do. But we're creating more unemployment than we are employment. And I feel that litigation, the ESA issues, if you look at rural Oregon and how that's now starting to affect the valley, you look at GATT, NAFTA, the difficulty of any business to compete in the global market because of the expenses that we're incurring. We don't have an even playing field. That creates the lack of opportunity. And specifically to what Senator Carr was talking about, community colleges and rural opportunity and the fact that you need a trained workforce, we're taking away some of that capacity. It was only last session that our community colleges really had a boost for the first time in years. It was higher ed had it before. And this recession, though it has affected Oregon, we were in trouble for the last 10 to 15 years in rural Oregon. This isn't anything new. And there's something that was pushing that. And I really think if you look at the ESA issues, you look at forestry, which was huge in all of Oregon other than right in the valley, you look at the commercial fishing, you look at ag, all of those are still under that gun. And every time there's a disagreement, we just had one where the Pacific Rivers Council sued the state forester. Every time something happens, there's a lawsuit, causes expense, causes unemployment. And this is a no-win thing over time until we address that issue, and that's ESA at the federal level. We can work, we can help, but long-term, that's what has to happen.
Well, I agree.
Okay, if I can take you to page 13. These are our new performance measures. We began tracking in July of 2002. We believe that our new set of measures will reflect the services that are more within our control. They are ratios, which better represent our effectiveness, we believe. And we also think these new measures will help us to assess the effects of changes in our service delivery strategies that we make and in our program components. The first measure...
Maybe it's just because it's Monday morning. These are new performance measures. What were the other ones we just looked at?
Those have been the historical ones we've tracked for a number of years that we will continue collecting data on.
So you've just added more. Is that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dukes, as we worked with the Progress Board, they asked us to give them outcome-related measures. And so since the federal government was going in that direction too, these are the ones that have been adopted by the Progress Board. They're not the only ones we're going to be tracking. When we talked about this presentation, I didn't want to bring you four measures that didn't have any data. I wanted to show you what it was we'd been doing over the last few years. So we included the historical ones and, again, ones that we'll continue to track. But these are the ones that have been adopted by the Progress Board.
Okay. So we won't be using the ones we just went through as performance measures anymore.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that's right. They aren't the ones that we'll be turning into the Progress Board, but we certainly can show you any of the performance data that we've got and any of the tracking measures that we've got that you're interested in seeing.
Just for me, if you're not going to choose them next year, you probably didn't need to give it to me. That's okay. Thank you.
The first new performance measure, will measure the value of our services. It will show the proportion of those who register with the Employment Department that we are able to place in a new job. The second performance measure shows, in my mind, if that job was a good fit, because it measures whether or not they are still working 6 months later. And then finally, the last two that we're showing you are customer satisfaction measures. One will measure employer satisfaction with the services they receive with the department, and one will measure job seekers.
Thank you, Chair George. We're going to be here a while.
I just said to Rick, we better add the third day. But don't worry about this.
A few minutes earlier, I talked about the partnerships that you have with other state agencies, and that leads me directly into your first two performance measures. Can you tell me how many of your OIA parolees or your DOC parolees are immediately registered with the Employment Department for
I do not have that information with me, and I'm not sure if something is not, but I'll go back and find out if it is a number we can pull.
But the reason I asked that question, Chair George, is I think there's a partnership and a potential savings to the state of Oregon. When you look at the public safety OIA and DOC budget, you see an effort by those folks to try and place some of their parolees into employment, and yet that's not what their skill or their profession is, and they're using general fund dollars. And I think there's an opportunity for the Employment Department to immediately partner with these folks. And if you look at recidivism rates and you ask both the directors of both those departments, they'll tell you that those individuals that are actively employed, coming right out of the system, have a much lower recidivism rate than those that are released and are not employed. And so I think there's multiple ways for the state of Oregon to save money, and at some point I'd like to continue to explore that with you.
I will tell you that we do have contracts with those agencies. There is a program that is modeled after a successful incarcerated vets program at Oregon piloted. And so we do work with these individuals prior to release. But I will come back with what numbers I have on that.
Just one minute.
Certainly.
If that's the case, then can you tell me how many of those individuals, once they're released, were employed at least two quarters after registering with the Employment Department?
Yes.
Thank you.
Good questions.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, the performance measures, three or four new ones they've got there, they're linked normally to goals. Are they the same goal on every one of those? And it might be of value to know what that performance measure's goal was. Does that show somewhere?
The new performance measures? At this point, we are collecting our first baseline year of information, and at that time, we will be establishing goals that we believe are realistic, but also, frankly, push the department to increase those numbers.
So now you don't... you don't really know what your goal is.
That's Mr. Chair. Krieger, I'm sorry. Our goal will be, I believe we will be looking at the numbers that we have historically done with our output measures, and then look to improve that in our ratios. So I cannot give you a direct ratio that we're striving for now, but we will be looking to compare how we've done historically and make sure that we are not falling behind in that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith raises a good concept, and that's of, and I think this could be a valuable theme for us to look in as a public safety committee. There's a lot of human services that are generated within the Department of Corrections for people leaving that I think we've got other agencies that might be in a better position to work on those. And I guess the example would be, obviously, employment services, food stamp services. The concept would be, why does somebody leave the penitentiary or leave incarceration and then have to, instead of being out looking for work and doing the things that we really want them to do, they oftentimes have to spend, you know, that time, the first couple weeks after they're out of the institution, of applying for food stamps, getting their Oregon health card, doing these types of things that I think if they were done before they left incarceration, one, there'd be more valuable thing for them to be doing. The other thing that I'm, in terms of the budget crunch that we're in, most of those services are paid for with a great deal of federal match. And if we could get those services provided on the federal government's nickel rather than the Department of Corrections, which is almost all general fund, if there's a way for us to structurally look at that, there might be some real dollar savings to us. And it would have to be, you know, very carefully and very thoughtfully worked out. But for sure, for example, in the food stamp area, if we could have a federally funded food stamp position rather than local correction officers having to kind of shepherd them around and get them in their food stamp intakes and stuff, I think there might be some dollar savings. And I think in employment there might be some similar situations, although these are real specialties. I mean, there's a lot of... it takes somebody pretty dedicated, and there's an awful lot of employers that won't hire a fella, and it's a pretty specialized hiring skills in order to get people coming out of prison into a situation that really fits them. But I think if we could look into it, there might be some overall dollar savings to the state of Oregon if we still maintain the same service level.
Mr. Chair.
Did you want to comment to Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I'm looking at my list of contracts. We do have contracts with some of the county corrections officials, and I know we have some people stationed in the jails. Columbia County did a big grand opening last summer, invited me up there. Our employment staff up there had done a really nice program to get people on job release, a job so that they're working by the time they're actually released. We don't have anybody actually housed in the Department of Corrections right now. We do have our kiosks out there so they can begin job search before they get out. There is a program, and I'd be glad to get a description of it. Region 3, the Workforce Region 3 here, the Title I-B providers, the community college, and we, our local Salem office, are working together. It was on an early release program for youth offenders. Something I'm trying to remember the numbers. It seems like there were something like 3,000 young people being released over the next 2 or 3 years, and we were setting up the kinds of human services you were talking about, as well as employment services, to prepare them so that they'd hit the ground running when they got out. So we do have a number of those kinds of efforts going, and we can bring back more descriptions of exactly what we've got going right now.
Thank you. That would be very helpful. I'd be very interested in looking at where the funding revenue stream is. For example, if the state of Oregon paying you for these contracts, or a county paying them, then it's coming out of some pretty mm-hmm. tight budgets. Mm-hmm. And if there was a way that we could be using the federally supported dollars to provide those services, I think that's where we'd get the buck savings.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, we don't have a contract right now with the state. I know the Washington County Corrections just pulled its contract with us on Saturday. We had a half an FTE, so we're trying to figure out if we can keep that half FTE going until they figure out if they can refund it. But, yeah, we will take a look at what services we provide, where that funding comes from.
I guess it's the efficiency. I mean, you know, somebody coming out of the penitentiary are eligible for these services once they get out. But if we can make it so that they're getting the services before they get out, I mean, then we mm-hmm. don't get into that lag time where somebody is out and adrift, either with no food stamps, no job. I mean, that's when we drive the recidivism rate, if we lose them in those first couple weeks, mm-hmm. where if we could get them coming out with the pretty minimal levels of support that we give people. But at least that, in a lot of cases, that's the difference between them being successful or going back in.
Deborah, can we get a read as to whether or not there is any opportunity for additional federal dollars that might in fact do that?
Ah.
Oh, and then Senator Carter.
We're already getting federal dollars.
Well, I mean, additional.
I want to just take you back to my point.
Okay.
That's where the disconnect is. The dollars that we had with OIA.
Mm-hmm.
The dollars that was used to be with the Employment Division, and we took some of the dollars away to get to OIA, so the OIA would work with youth organizations
mm-hmm.
For employment opportunity.
Even with prisoner release.
Okay. They're supposed to be able to go to those communities, and they work on what we call the hard to hire, those people who don't have the life skills mm-hmm. that they need to be in the marketplace, and they should be connecting with the skill centers. And we have 8 skills, and we have to ask Debbie from time to time. She would be modest, Mr. Chairman, but if you ask her to put on her former commissioner hat of community colleges, and she could talk about that system connection.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a disconnect in that particular kind of way. And how do we get the thing is getting the workforce investment people to come in and talk about their different connections and how they connect with the Employment Department, how they connect with DOC and the OIA, and who's responsible actually for making sure the jobs are done. We can't do anything because those are all federal dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they're supposed to be doing. And the Youth Opportunity Center work with young people between the ages of 16 and 21, and those are your federal dollars that comes into these community centers. And when they get out of prison, the first place they should be going, if they're OIA, is to our Youth Opportunity Centers in our communities. And so that's where the question began, because employment don't even see those people.
That brings up a thought. Will you guys help us with that? Because I think the question with Representative Hansen, what Senator Carter talked about, is there a linkage to where this goes back into the point in which they're still incarcerated and then provides that at the time of release? In other words, they're walking out of there with everything they need in order to, you know, to hit the ground with, you know, with training, with food stamps, whatever they need to not be tempted to go back in and not commit another crime in order to sustain themselves. And is there a window of opportunity there for federal dollars? I know they have to be thinking that way, because if there is a break between the time they would leave the prison and the time they would reach that center, mm-hmm. You've got to fill that gap or you're going to lose a bunch of them.
We don't mandate anymore. If we mandate them, they have to go through one of those programs for an additional 6 months. They go to the skill centers, which we pay for as a state,
mm-hmm.
and get some training, life skill training, computer training, the whole ball of wax. But when they get out, they just left on the street as opposed to being mandated.
Okay.
We'll follow up on that.
Yes. Go ahead. Or you had a follow-up? And then we'll
no, I said we would follow up on that question.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair George. Senator Carter, Representative Hansen, you folks are right on. I've been talking with several upper managers in DOC and OIA, and one of them, what they suggested was having an employment department person literally reassigned, say, to OIA as a one-stop shop person mm-hmm. who, as these people are coming through, getting ready to be handed their slip to go out the door, they're literally signed up, and they're put on a track, and that person watches them.
and they really see the need for this, and it reduces recidivism, which frees up general fund dollars. So anyway.
So this came in at the city they talk. We need to help develop a system for that to happen.
Yeah, we have to. Today's the last day. Somebody better draft a bill in a hurry.
I'll do this.
You'll do that.
I'll take care of it.
Okay.
I'll co-sponsor this in itself.
Thank you. I'll bring it by now.
Mr. Chair, I would only add that I do know that there are federal grants available for these kinds of activities. We tend to be aware of the ones. We've been a successful candidate as a state for a number of incarcerated veteran programs, and they've been highly, highly successful. And what I'm wondering is if, in fact, different program areas potentially have grants that we would not be aware of, because we aggressively go after, frankly, everyone we are aware of. But maybe in working with some of these other state agencies, we could become familiar with some funding streams that we are not familiar with at this point. So we will follow up.
Senator Dukes?
Nowhere near to the level of what we've been talking about here. Well, I understand that you now have 4 performance measures as opposed to the 14 we had.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, we actually have 3, 4. Well, in this program, we have 4 performance measures. The employment services program that Jan is responsible for. We have additional performance measures in unemployment insurance, the hearings panel, child care, and we're working on research. But again, we track a lot more statistics and performance than we are presenting to the progress board, and what we've got here is simply what we presented to the progress board.
What I'm going to ask you to do is to develop a performance measure based on the long-term structurally unemployed that Senator Carter has been talking
about. We'd be glad to do that. I think we could do that very easily. Thank you.
We'll get back to work. We stopped you just as you got started.
Well, I've got close to the end. Just write that. Okay, if you could turn to page 14. This is information from the July through September 2002 that our Federal Department of Labor collects on all states, but these are our regional states. And as you can see, Oregon, I think, holds up quite well to its sister states. Our job search activity total is substantially more than any other state in the region. We have a strong emphasis on claimant reemployment. 3/4 of our claimants receive a staff-assisted service, while only 6% in California receive that service. And although Washington looks like their percentage is extremely high, their numbers are actually lower than Oregon's, and I believe that's a reflection that they only register those who receive services. So they have quite good numbers in that area.
Mr. Chair, I understand the last piece, but Washington has a population twice Oregon's.
Absolutely.
And their unemployment rates are roughly where ours are, maybe just a little bit better, 10% or something. So how is it that with all of those folks and that low or high in unemployment rate, and you probably can't answer for Washington, those numbers just look unusual to me.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, a number of states only have the federal Wagner-Peiser money to do employment services and job services. And as I mentioned earlier, that's been flat for 10 years. So in many states, the employment services piece is very rudimentary because we do have a state-driven fund, the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Fund, to support those services. We're able to provide more. But my recollection is that Washington doesn't have anything beyond the Wagner-Peiser money.
So they have a rudimentary system, twice our population, and lower numbers seeking mm-hmm. employment, mm-hmm. but roughly the same amount.
Through their employment services.
I'm curious as to where the rest of those folks are. They must be using private. Sounds like they're doing a fairly good job of it.
Or they're skewing the numbers. I think.
I'm sorry.
I said, or they're skewing the numbers. And I think that our, to me now, to me personally, it appears to me that this is a more honest system. That our system is a more honest system. in the sense that it actually is registering those people that are coming to them and gives us the actual number of those that are unemployed. And that's why Oregon was, it would appear to me, we were given a special concession in January to extend our UI insurance, because our numbers actually show the high level of the unemployed.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I believe the extended benefits, the additional money that we got, is triggered by how high your unemployment rate is.
Right.
So, yeah, our numbers were the highest, obviously, in the state. I believe Washington and Alaska were also up there, but I don't recall for sure.
The kind of areas to show
exactly
that we show, and that's what I'm saying.
Because the feds track everybody's unemployment rate, and we see theirs, and we track theirs with ours because they're a border state.
But if they don't have all these earmarks,
yeah, there's something missing.
That would be interesting to see.
I guess the last comment I would make is that we also refer far more job seekers than any other state, as a percentage, rather than except for Idaho. What I don't know, as we've talked about the underfunding of the system, many states are moving towards a system, frankly, where they do not interact individually in person with job seekers, or for that matter, employers. They are doing far more electronic means, and although we're trying to develop that so that people who prefer that can use those kinds of systems, we still do a lot of face-to-face referrals. That's the bulk of our work right now. And we do focus a lot on the employer. So it's not clear at this point to me if that's those numbers are a reflection of how we do business versus other states, or if, in fact, they just aren't seeing the folks that we are.
Startling number when you look at that. You know, here we are at 54%, 42,000, off 43,000, and there was 6,900. And Washington State.
To start with, thank you, Mr. Chair. To start with, it would be interesting to see what these states allocate from their within their budgets for unemployment programs, and then how they do it. Presumably, they're much less than what we provide in our state. It would be interesting to do a comparison. I'm not asking you to do that because it might be a little bigger task and becomes a policy issue here. But
Deborah, if I understood you right, one of the reasons we're able to do this is the Supplemental Employment Department Administrative Funds that we have in reserves.
That's right, Mr. Chairman. We can would be able to find out first if other states put additional money in from their own budgets, or whether they work entirely off federal money. And an overall budget for them. I think I'm sure we've got those. We get those kinds of allocations in lists of states.
If you have that, that would be interesting.
We'll see what we can find.
To know.
Where do these statistics come from on page 14?
These statistics come from the U.S. Department of Labor. We report to them, we all states report to them on a number of measures so that they can track the effectiveness of each agency.
Do I understand correctly here that of all the people who come through the door looking for a job, and I'm assuming this is an annual figure, that 56% of them get sent out on some type of a job interview?
You're looking at the second to last column on the right-hand side? Yes.
What happens to the rest of them? Are they not qualified? Do they need more training? Are they already employed, but they're just kind of looking around? Who are the rest of these people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we do see a number of people who are employed and looking for a better job. We certainly see people who are unemployed. Claimants make up, as you can see from the numbers, a large percentage, about half of the people that we work with. We do consider the employer our primary customer. We do screen to ensure that the most qualified of our applicants are sent to an employer when they have a job listing with us. If, in fact, an individual does not meet the skill and the occupational history requirements that an employer is looking for, we do try to refer them to a job that better matches their history. And we also make an assessment around if a referral to one of our partners for training or some kind of community services would be a more effective service for them to receive, and then do that as well. So,
but 44% of the people who come through your doors looking for a job don't ever get referred out for an interview. That just seems to me a large number. Now, I don't fully appreciate mm-hmm. all the kinds of people right. probably that come through your doors. That just, it surprised me. And you said something else that I hadn't realized before, and that's that the employer is your customer, so not the person who's looking for a job. That surprised me as well. I'm learning.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I would also say this would not include the numbers of people who are able to self-refer. We had approximately 19,000 of our job orders last year are what we call self-refer. They're somewhat like a want ad. You directly, the employer has the job seeker directly contact them rather than being screened for skills and history by the employment department.
But right now that would probably be a fairly low number, wouldn't you think?
Actually,
even Burger King isn't doing a lot of hiring these days.
Well, we can certainly check and see what we have and potentially bring something back.
Senator Dukes, when there are some groups that probably don't need referrals, for example, construction workers that are union construction workers, they go back to work through the union hiring hall, so it's the referral is... You're registered through the union hiring hall, and you're not really dealing, and you're not really looking for work outside of that system. And then, for example,
job seekers; these aren't claimants.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, okay. There's a nuance there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just wonder what happens to them. Do they just sort of float out there?
By definition, though, are claimants job seekers? You have to.
Absolutely.
Well, they're not claimants anymore.
Positive incentive.
Okay. That concludes my remarks at this point, unless you have other questions for this part of the.
Can I just ask one question? So, if a person has just gotten out of DOC and they were to come to the employment division, is there a particular area that they would go to that specifies that this person was a felon, and so therefore a particular person would go? How does that work? Now, I know OYA, but I'm talking about the adult prison.
If they, Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, if they are released and on probation, sometimes their probation officer will work with us kind of laying out the rules and regulations, the kinds of jobs they might not be eligible to be sent to. But if they have served their time and they come in and do not self-declare and the parole system does not notify us, then we are not necessarily aware that they are newly released from prison. Now, sometimes that will come up in, you know, the employment history discussion, and that, you know, again, they are eligible to refer themselves to positions that are open in our self-refer system, and at this point, we don't always know who those
are. Let's just a person in my district, and this person called and said, Senator Carter, I just got out of prison, and I want to seek employment. Mm-hmm. I've been unemployed for more than 10 years, and every time I get out, I look for a job. I can't find any job. When I know anything, I'm back there again because I can't find employment, so I can eat or whatever. Now, I'm going to take such a person, and I'm going to walk them to the system. Where's the first place I take them?
Mr. Chairman Senator Carter, I'd take them probably to the North Portland office.
Okay.
We have contacts with all sorts of
partners who can sit down and figure out what that person needs, what kind of training, what kind of education, what kind of life skills, what kind of work ethic skills that person may need, and we can get them started through that system. If that person's job ready and ready to go, we can find them a job.
Mr. Chairman, I will not be here in the morning because I want to do such a thing. I'm going to see how it works. I'm going to see how it works. I will not be here in the morning, and that's what I'm going to do in North Portland.
Senator Carter, is it okay if I call Cynthia Ann Warner?
Absolutely.
You should have warned them.
That's fine. I'm taking off in the morning because I want to know how it works. We're living in such a critical time right now. Legislators are under fire because they think we're not doing anything for people who are poor, and our budgets reflect, you know, in what we're doing, that the poor are suffering the most. I mean, we're developing our budgets on the backs of the poor. So tomorrow, that's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take this person, I'm going to North Portland, and I'm going to see what we do. As a matter of fact, there might be a couple, two or three of them.
We will consider you a subcommittee of one in the.
That's right. If somebody want to go with me, Senator, if you want to go, I mean, Representative Hansen, you want to go with me, that's fine.
Oh, no, I don't. But but I think the mission is very worthwhile.
That's right.
One thing I'd like you to be observing, and I'd like feedback maybe at a later point, what you laid out in terms of the services that are available to that person once they get to the North Portland office. I'd like us to be thinking how many of those services could be provided before they're released.
Right. Then that's your question.
So that they're hitting the ground running rather than starting from scratch. I mean, when somebody's incarcerated, there's a lot of time to be working on planning and assessment and those type of things. And when they're out of jail, they need to be actually on the street, either looking for work or starting to work,
right,
or they're going to fail again. But so maybe if you could be looking at what level of those services actually could occur before they're released.
I'm calling it's trickier
than it looks. For example, somebody getting out of Snake River,
mm-hmm,
it's pretty hard to link. It's a lot harder to link them up in terms of employers in North Portland when they're coming back to their home community after they're released. But in terms of the plans and the assessment, those types of things could be done ahead of time.
Senator Carter, I'd like to suggest to you, if we move along, you know, we could end this thing, their presentation tomorrow, and then possibly I'd like to go with you in there just explore this too. If we finish up and we have the third day available.
Okay. Then I'll
give
wait.
Give us several hours before our session.
Yeah. I'll wait and do that.
Senator Dukes.
No, I'm going to go on.
Okay.
So what's going on with the four facilities of OIA inmates that are going to be released if they haven't already been released? And the other thing I was going to say was, Senator Carter's point brings up another one that's good. Even those of us who've been here a while don't necessarily know what your services are. When she asked the question, I know exactly what I would do. I would call Joyce Aho, and if that woman ever retires, I'm in deep trouble.
So are we.
Whom I have known and worked with for more years than I care to. I mean, before either of us were in that position, because she's wonderful, and she has at least two, maybe three of my counties.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just some of your folks might want to touch base from time to time because, except for an unusual situation like I have, we don't always know who they are or what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But what does happen to these OIA folks?
Sorry, I don't know. But
nobody has made prior arrangements with you, I take it. Or you would know.
Not
okay.
With me directly. Perhaps with the local field office.
You know where the ones who weren't are going to be. I'll stay here. Oh.
And see, not, Mr. Chairman, that's the thing I was trying to point out. Mm-hmm. It's not an employment division problem. It's a systems problem.
Yeah.
And when you have that kind of disconnect, I imagine we can't even go to DOC. We can't go to the employment. We can't go to OIA. What we need to do is call everybody in and see how can we, the legislature, who do the people's business, can develop the kind of system where these kind of issues take place. And so I imagine it's just a matter of us putting the system together, because we are actually the ones that need to be answering to them. And if these people don't talk, it's not because they maybe don't want to talk. We haven't mandated them to talk.
Mm-hmm. Jen, I understand you completed your presentation.
You're so slow. You understand? I guess that's a red. This is all in quite my schooling.
Senator Morris.
Chairman, thank you. With respect to page 14 and the data that's on that and the information that you'd be collecting with respect to the other states, mm-hmm. would it be possible to get a sense of what these other states' tax structures are compared to ours? The $1.5 billion reserve fund that we have for unemployment insurance, how that compares to other states? The question behind that is, are we over-collected?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, I'd be glad to do that. That's an interesting question. There are a number of states who went broke during this, whose trust funds went broke during this recession, had to borrow from the federal government, which mm-hmm. does have a pot of money available for that. Our trust fund is self-adjusting. That is, in good times, we collect enough to have a benchmark level in the trust fund so that in bad times, we don't have to raise taxes. And we can go into more detail on that later if you'd like. But I think ours is one of the trust funds whose solvency is a credit to the way the legislature set this up years ago.
And also the bond rating.
Senator Dibbs?
The statistics are going to kill me. Total UI claimants registered in, I assume ES is Employment Service.
Mm-hmm.
Percent of total job seekers, 50%. I thought all UI claimants had to be. Oh, you're back.
I realized I wasn't quite finished. Mr. Chair, Senator Dibbs. All claimants are registered in our Oregon Job Selection System. That said, claimants who are union or employer attached get their jobs back through that union hall and or return to work within 8 weeks to an employer that has had a temporary layoff. So although I believe, I'm looking, where's the number? What this is showing is that the claimants are in the system, but they actually make up half of all of the names in our system. So at this time, half of the individuals registered in our job system are claimants, even if they will go back to their former employer.
Okay. I thought you were going to say that maybe the other half of this was union and temporary layoffs, because that would make sense. Now, we have a lot of businesses today going into what they hope will be temporary layoff, what they expect
right.
will be temporary layoff. Are they required to be out looking for jobs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, if in fact it is they have a return to work date, they that they are perceived to be looking for work by waiting to return to that employer.
Okay.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
So does that include, like I know... certain employees in school districts across the state have this 3-month layoff period. Certain employees in the county system have a 3-month. Are they a part of your numbers? Well, because they obviously have a date to return date, so they're not a part of your numbers, even though that they draw money during that period of time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, they would certainly be registered in the system, and I'm wondering if Tom Byerly might be better able. School districts are a very unique part of the population because of how we track and the requirements of whether they are still attached. But typically, I believe most of them are considered employer attached.
Okay.
I'm correct.
Okay.
Any further questions for me? Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to invite Graham Slater up. Page 15 starts his section. Graham is the administrator of the Workforce and Economic Research Division of the department. This is labor market information. These are the folks who figure out and publish the unemployment rate, just to put him in context.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. And given that we're in a recession, I'm not sure that was a very nice introduction. It's all my fault, right?
That's right.
So, for the record, I'm Graham Slater, and as Debbie said, the administrator of the Workforce and Economic Research Division at the Employment Department. We'll be chatting mostly from page 15 in your new handout from this morning. But if I may, I'd just like to comment on a couple of things, particularly sitting there listening to all that's been discussed. We're a pretty small part of the employment department, roughly 60 people, fairly small budget, and that's fine the way it is. But I do think that the role we play is pretty important, because without the information from our area, a lot of this information about the rural areas and the recession and the unemployed and so on, we simply wouldn't have that information if we didn't have the kind of people who do the number crunching and the surveys and the analysis and so on. As I was preparing for this testimony just a couple of weeks ago, the General Accounting Office in the federal government came out with a special report that said that $40 billion of the federal government's money is allocated to the states based on the numbers that come out of our shop, or our shop in each state, as we compare unemployment rates and so on. So that gives you a measure. You know, it may just be a few people cranking out a few numbers, but big money and big decisions rest on those numbers eventually. The whole discussion this morning about Department of Corrections has been pretty interesting. One thing I can tell you, something that we can do before those people leave the prisons or leave the correctional facilities, is that they can have access to our information, and we do that very strongly. We publish 160,000 copies of a newspaper called Careers every year. It goes to every high school in the state, every junior high, every one-stop, and all of the prisons. And Oregon's Career Information System, you may have heard of that. It's a very in-depth career development system, and the Department of Corrections are part of that system. And we're kind of the oversight of a partnership between our agency and several others that gives all that career information to those folks before they ever set foot outside the door. So we're not just talking about today's job, but about the long-term jobs that would be a good suit for their skills and background. Okay, with that little introduction, I'll go back to page 15. And in the context of the Oregon benchmarks, there's nothing that we do. I mean, we don't produce widgets. We don't find people jobs in my area. There's nothing that we do that directly contributes success to us meeting those benchmarks. However, we're the ones that tell the Progress Board how Oregon's doing on some of those things. For example, earlier Senator Dukes asked about employment dispersion. You know, two-word phrase that may not mean a lot. Basically, what that benchmark attempts to do is measure how many of Oregon's jobs are outside of the Portland and Willamette Valley area. So when it was first set up years ago...
To get your
right. And this is a benchmarks progress board definition. It's been there for years. And the goal is that over time, more and more jobs, the goal was anyway, more and more jobs would be in those rural areas, not all in the Willamette Valley. And if you look at the numbers, they really haven't changed a whole lot over a decade. It's roughly 25% of all the jobs are out there as opposed to being right here. But that's just an example of how does the Progress Board, how do Oregonians know if we're improving on those benchmarks? It's because we're cranking out those numbers and providing them back to them. So,
you said the goal was...
Well,
did it change?
I'm saying starting back in 1980 when the benchmarks were first introduced.
And before I forget about it, been wondering for years who I could complain to, and you're it. when you do the statistics, you lump the Tri-County area and Columbia County together. And it drives me nuts. Columbia County is much smaller, and yes, I understand why for your purposes that makes sense, but for somebody who's trying to track the unemployment rate in Columbia County or any of the other statistics related to Columbia County, I've never been able to do it. I can get my other counties, but I can't do Columbia.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, you should be able to get the Columbia County specific data. We do publish it in the Portland Labor Trends each month. The history there, very briefly, is that every time the census is done, the federal government makes a determination of which counties have enough commuting that they're all considered one economic area. That's why Columbia got...
And I understand that, but in terms of trying to track whether... Because they're so far overshadowed by the other three that they could easily get lost in the shuffle. And in terms of trying to understand what's going on with that population, and are they still... getting the employment services they need? Are they going up and down?
Okay, Senator Dukes, again, we do, because people like yourselves asked for it, even though it's not the official Bureau of Labor Statistics sanctioned number, we do publish each month the table of Multnomah and Clackamas and Yamhill, because they got sucked into Portland in the 1980 census, and Columbia County's the unemployment rates. And Al Stobig, I think you've worked with him over the years, our economist for that area, he still does make individual Columbia County estimates each month, even though he's not required to.
He's got the one sheet that's got everything, and they're never on there.
Right.
And then there's the multi-paged one. Is that the one?
The multi-paged one. Okay. But if you'd like a copy emailed to you each month, we could certainly do that. I mean,
okay.
So you don't have to look through all the Portland stuff.
Just the statistics. Yeah.
Okay.
Graham, is that available on the website?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you could go, we could go to the website and look up our individual counties.
Definitely.
Okay.
Okay.
Hit the button.
Be happy to. Yeah, I'd be happy to step you through that. Okay, so as you can see there, we in the number two at the top, we do provide the information for the benchmarks. And then we also believe that the information we provide helps businesses decide. In fact, one of our customer groups is businesses and economic development types who are trying to figure out, should we move into this area? Will there be enough of a workforce? What's the average wage for the kinds of jobs that we'd be hiring people for? So we work pretty closely with those folks. As far as performance measures, particularly for my area of responsibility, as someone else said, with some of the federal programs, we have some very, very detailed measures, if you will, contract deliverables is the phrase that most often used for our survey programs. We have to meet certain survey response rates and accuracy rates and so on. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, part of the federal government, pays for almost all of the data collection that we do, which is a wonderful thing for Oregon because all those basic numbers that we rely on so much are paid for in these contracts with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So as we looked at performance measures for ourselves for the future, it's a pretty hard thing to do. We serve such a variety of customers, and every customer's needs are different. It's not like paying people unemployment claims, where there's at least some kind of continuity with it. But we came up with three measures of data quality. Two of them have to do with our survey programs, and there we're looking at response rates to make sure that we have enough information in to meet statistical validity. One of them has to do with occupational employment and one with industry employment. We think that will be a pretty fair measure. And then the third one will have to do with the amount of our revisions each year. Every year, every month, we go through and make estimates of employment based on this survey of Oregon employers. And then once a year, we do a big revision, or it's a big project. Hopefully the revision is small, and that's what this third one will be. For example, in 2001, our revision was 0.2% at that total employment level. And our goal is to keep that within a 0.6 plus or minus range. And over the years, we can track how well we've done. A couple of years, we missed it. Most years, we've been within that. In all three of those measures, I would say also that we are doing much better than the national average and better than Bureau of Labor Statistics requirements. So I think we're in good shape. Then the fourth measure that we're working on is customer satisfaction. We've always done customer satisfaction surveys on particular publications. What do you use? What do you like? Does it meet your data needs, your information needs? But we are working on developing a more complete customer satisfaction survey. And in fact, a lot of the research entities, our counterparts in other states, are doing the same thing. We do count every letter of thanks that we get, and that's kind of a little gauge. And just throw out for you, in 2002, we counted 691 specific letters of thanks because our information was useful. And 140 of those came from private businesses and employer associations, and about 100 of them came from educational entities. Our information is used for career planning and, for example, community colleges deciding which programs they might want to offer because of the jobs of the future. The final two measures relate to customer service, the amount of customer service, and one that we've already started counting as of last year is the number of customer contacts we have. And that's kind of a number that we get at by adding up the total number of publications that we distribute, mm-hmm. the number of people who attend the presentations that we make, and the number of specific information requests that we respond to. And I have more detail on that later in the binders. I'm not sure we'll get to them in the next few days. But the total number of customers that we touched and served last year out of our research section was 504,000. So more than 500,000 people contacted us, received from us information about the workforce, about the recession, and so on. And then the final measure will have to do with our website. And on an annual basis, by the end of last year, we were up to about 230,000 people logging into the website each year. So if you kind of put those two together, basically 750,000 opportunities for us to give that information to people that apparently need it, which to me is fairly high level for people that sometimes think of us as just number crunchers sitting in the corner. Okay. a brief comparison of other states. There really are no statistics. You know, Jan was able to give you a very nice comparison of claimants and placements and all those things. There's really nothing, because every state has a pretty different focus on their workforce and economic research. So let me just tell you the similarities and the differences, and some of you may have experienced some of these things. Every state has what's called a labor market information, or LMI group. That's the group that I'm in charge of. And all of us have statutory requirements under the Workforce Investment Act, serving businesses, serving workforce boards, serving education, collecting information, participating at the national level as well as the state level. So we all have those standard requirements. We meet them fairly differently, but they're there for us all. All the states operate these data collection and analysis programs funded by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So that's why the unemployment rates, when we say Oregon had the highest rate or this month the second highest rate, we can make that statement because Alaska's rate and California's rate were computed on the same methodology, the same basic program, so it does mean something to compare them. The one thing I'll comment there is that Oregon's Bureau of Labor Statistics programs are very highly rated. We won a national award last year, and one of our industry employment statistics program is often used as the test program to test out new ideas and new methodologies. We're just fortunate to have some long-time staff who are kind of recognized, and they've been around long enough to be relied on nationally. The third one there is that all states produce a number of core products for a different U.S. Department of Labor grant that comes to us each year. Particularly important ones are the projections that we do. We look out 10 years. We're not trying to measure the recession's ups and downs. We're trying to measure the long-term trend so that people leaving high school, maybe people leaving prison, can be training for occupations that are going to be around and growing in the long term, not just today's short-term needs. We've also done a lot of products for our one-stop customers. As of January 1st of this year, every employment department field office has a rack with this career information on it, and it's kind of a standard package that they'll all have. Phase two of that is moving that out to all the one-stop offices too, for these other agencies. And then, of course, our website is available to all of them, wherever they are, over the net. The differences in Oregon, probably the big one, and one that we're recognized nationally for, and sometimes we're a pain to the federal government on this, but it's the importance of the local and regional information. Well before my time, well before Debbie's time, directors of this department have said it's important for us to have research kind of people, economists, out there all across Oregon. Living in the communities, going to the chambers of commerce, understanding what's going on in those areas, and reading the papers, and doing the statistical computations. So we have
And that is true. They do that. When I was president of the Urban League, I called upon these guys, and I talked to Debbie one day. 2 days later, Graham was talking to me at his people talked to me at the Urban League of Portland. They really do go to communities and talk to them about job outlooks and economic development strategies. So kudos to you.
Thank you very much. Okay. And they're located as far away as La Grande and Baker City and Medford on the coast and so on all around the state. We also play a role on that local data issue at the national level. I've been fortunate to serve as the co-chair of a national committee, which is in charge of the industry estimates for the nation. And I'll just share with you that those people in D.C. at the Bureau of Labor Statistics wish they'd never heard of Baker County, because it's the one that I always use as an example. To them, it doesn't seem that important. And I just used it in one conversation, and it stuck. And so now, frequently, they'll ask me on the phone, so what's happening in Baker County? They have no clue where it is, but they know that it's one that's always being thrown in their face. Our website has been recognized, won a number of national awards in the last 6 years, and literally, as I said, 220,000 to 240,000 people looking at it, which is not bad for a statistics site. And it has all the information on all the regions of the state and the most current news on the economy and so on. Turning the page, something we do different, now on page 16, is that we do have the opportunity, again because of support from our directors and legislators over the past, to produce a lot more publications than a lot of states. If you look at a lot of states' websites, it's tables and numbers, and that's about all they do. And again, the careers newspaper, we have a weekly little email news thing we do, just openings and closings, layoffs around the state. We have a couple things we do every other year that are very in-depth, not easy reading for the typical person, but for government planners or for corporate planners, they're probably pretty important publications. So 476,000 publications last year. And most of those, almost all of them, at the state and the regional level. We did a survey of employers last year, and we deliberately chose the sample so that we'd have reliable numbers at the state and local levels. You won't find many states doing that. Our workforce analyst program is a group of our staff. Again, they're spread around the state in all of our different field offices, and their only mission in life, as I tell them, is to make our kind of stuff relevant for businesses. Okay, so we're talking about businesses that are recruiting and they don't know how much to offer in wages, and we can help them with that. Or what skills are needed for particular jobs. Maybe it's a small company that really hasn't had to hire before. It was a family thing, and now they're starting to add people, and they've never dealt with position descriptions and those things, and these folks can help them. So that's a program of 14 people, again, all across the state, and I get calls frequently from other states, or when I'm at conferences, I give speeches on this, because other states are pretty interested. Two or three others have tried to do it in a small way to try to get some of their folks really focused on businesses, because if the business then get good information, they're hiring people, and that's, of course, what we're all about. And then finally, the I'm sorry.
Senator Duke.
How does that work with the small business development centers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, some of our folks are really closely tied into those. I just know them from seeing that in October we did a list of customer tracking. You know, that's how we came up with some of these numbers. And I know that the small business development folks are on our customer list. I could find out some specific examples if you'd like.
It just seemed to me that developing position descriptions and things like that would fit well into what they're doing.
Okay. So. I would agree, yeah. Would you like me to do some additional follow-up just so you get some examples?
Well, not examples. I guess I'd like to know where there's duplication.
Okay.
You know, what they're doing compared to what you're doing.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, Senator Drews, we'll just do some checking on that. Okay, thanks. And then the last one there is the performance reporting information system, which, again, a lot of states call us and ask about this. Some of you have been around long enough to know the shared information system, which is a way of figuring out, did the people that move through the workforce agencies, do they actually get jobs? And did they stay in those jobs? And did their wages increase after in those jobs? With the Workforce Investment Act and so on, the Performance Reporting Information System will now, in most likelihood, take the place of the Shared Information System. It doesn't really matter to you. What it means is we are looking at all the people that come through these different workforce agencies, tracking them through the workforce and saying what percent of them actually found a job after this happened. The most recent numbers, because PRISM is very new, we only have one set of data, the most recent numbers would suggest 75% of them that come through any of these partner workforce agencies were working the quarter after they quit being served by Title I-B, or I won't say JTVA, Title I-B or the Employment Department or the community colleges or whoever. That's a different subject for a different committee this afternoon. but it is a difference between Oregon and other states. Most of them don't have that capability, especially with all of the partners collaborating. It's something that's been worked on here for about 10 years. So that ends my part, unless you have any additional questions.
Well, I don't see anybody holding up their hand, so I will. And that is, in the overview that Rick gave us, Graham, that at the end of it here, it says that they must also forecast changes in job growth and other economic factors. And so I had made a note as I was reading this over the weekend, let's hear the forecast, because we're trying to build a budget for 2 years. What would you, as you look into your crystal ball, what would you tell us?
Mr. Chair, I think it's going to be very slow. We do believe, based on our numbers, that we hit bottom in March of 2002, so that's good.
That's good.
Exactly as Tom Potowski, the state economist, had predicted, which I'm sure he feels good about. However, when we hit bottom, it just barely turned up. And so if you look at the last 7 or 12 months, employment has just been creeping up. The current projections, for example, it will take us until well into 2004 to get back to the employment level we were at way back in 2000 when the recession started. So it's a creeping, very, very slow recovery. And so as, you know, as far as your projections, I would not assume that you're going to see a rebound. It's more of just a kind of climbing your way back up.
Are we seeing any inward migration of folks coming here looking for jobs, or is that just come to a stop now?
Mr. Chair, there is still in-migration, nothing like the 90s, though. Probably less than half the rate of the 1990s. But yes, I mean, there is still inward migration. I don't know that many of them are coming here looking for jobs, because if they've been tracking the unemployment rates, most people would not come to the state with the highest rate or the second highest rate if they want to look for a job.
But Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. Graham, you're about to earn your paycheck on this question. The governor's budget is predicated upon an 18% growth factor. In your opinion, is 18% a realistic number that we can anticipate predicating our budget on?
Chair, Representative Smith, what is the 18% applying to? Is it employment growth or
revenue to the state?
16.3% actually, when you take away the one times. 16.3% increase in revenue growth.
Okay, well, Representative Smith, I'm not going to earn my paycheck. I'm going to dodge the question and say, to be honest, I don't have on those revenue issues. And, you know, Tom Potowski and his staff are the ones that really live and breathe that stuff. So so I'll just take my wallet out and give you back to me.
Smart man.
Let's rephrase the question then. And is it, have you found over the years that, I mean, to me it would be very basic, but, you know, then again, I'm just a farmer, that a relationship between the total employment and where the economy was going would be a direct relationship. Has that been historically the case?
Mr. Chair, there certainly is a relationship. I think, again, Tom could answer this better than me, but certainly one of the things that happened as we headed into the recession is that employment decreased by certain percentages and income and therefore tax revenues decreased by a whole lot more, because we're just measuring those people who are working. You know, the corporate profits were down, so corporate income taxes were down. The stock market, so whereas we may have had 2-4% decreases in employment, Tom Potowski's numbers were much more severe than that, because he's impacted by all those different kinds of income.
Which one of you was
the money back now?
Are you finished?
I am. Thank you,
Senator Carter.
Can we see, will we see the Freightliners, the Intels, and those larger companies whose receipts actually make a difference in terms of the upward percentage numbers of revenue, number of revenues that we would be getting to say? How slow will their climb be, you think?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I think company by company it will be different. Because if something great happens for truck needs, then you're going to see Freightliner add some people back tomorrow or next month. Okay. But as you look at the overall economy, I would still say it's going to be pretty slow. I did hear someone from the Electronics Association in a speech probably 3 or 4 months ago make the public statement that they don't expect the electronics, that part of the high-tech industry, ever to get back to the growth that they had in the 90s. So
if we were to look, Graham, at how the state prepares and the skill sets of those people at the bottom to meet this new economy, because what I think I hear you saying, so companies that are moving slower and determining on what happens in the system, we're looking at a higher level of skill need. And so with that in mind, how do you see us being able to respond to skill sets of the industries that will be growing? Because we are talking about higher level needs in terms of computer science, of computer, even those data entry needs and kind of skill sets. What would you say to us in terms of training needs that we would have to meet the demands of these companies as they regrow? Because it obviously is a regrow.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we do have, and I think the mayor is in the Urban League in that presentation, we do have lists of skills that we've developed that employers want, and it's not on, the focus is on what employers tell us they need for all of the 700 or 800 occupations that exist in the state. And based on those skills, from our website or from one-on-one contact in our field offices, you know, we do work with individuals, and we're able to point out to them, if you want to improve your job or even just to get back to a job, here's the skills that you have, but for those jobs, here's the ones that you don't have. And on our website, for example, it will connect them then right into the programs of training at a community college or a private career school or whatever, to say, here's how you can fill some of those gaps. Now, the folks at the Title I-B and our partner agencies, or vocational rehabilitation, who do a lot more in-depth work with customers, they use this stuff all the time. Private vocational counselors, Department of Human Services vocational folks, that is a way for them to get people in what they hope will be just the right training to at least get that first job and then on down the road.
Mr. Chairman, it would appear to me that, and Representative Krieger, I am a 30-year retired employee of the community college system, so I'm referred to as a community college queen around here, but they would also tell you that I can also be their greatest critic. So I just wanted to preface that before I make the statement I'm about to make to the chairman. It would appear to me, Mr. Chairman, that all of these people that are doing training development, if we're going to get a true hand on developing the skill sets that we need to embrace society in a meaningful way, we need to see if the skill sets that Graham and other people have looked at is truly what community colleges, their partner agencies are doing in terms of a life skills and training needs, and people just putting computers in a lab someplace and saying, we are a computer laboratory and getting money for it. We need to see if they really are producing, because that's really where the rubber meets the road. Because everybody that put up a shingle and say we're doing this, I'm not seeing this really happening. Because I had one such case with a young woman that had gone to a program supposedly over a 3-month period of time. And I'm telling you, it is unrealistic for the state or anybody else to believe that someone with no skills, no technical skills, no life training, can go into a program in 3 months and get the skill they need and go into the workplace. It is absolutely, positively unrealistic for it to happen. And I say that if we're really going to get ahead, and we truly mean that we want to put people to work in this state, then we need to start looking at performance measurements as well as objectives, as well as outcomes, to see if they're really doing that to the people that we are trying to serve in the state. Else this forecasting isn't going to mean anything. Mm-hmm. Else her trying to match partners, match her people with employers, it's not going to do anything because the people don't have the skill set. And then you know what going to happen? And migration happened in the 90s simply because we didn't have the skill sets ready for the people here. And so we sent in other states and got them, and in other countries even.
We're going to Senator Dukes. Senator Morris, Representative Hansen.
As you see the curve change slightly as we've begun to try to get out of this recession, is it even across different wage sets of jobs, or who's pulling out first? Is it the Burger Kings or clearly not the Intels, but I guess what I'm saying is it the minimum wage jobs that are starting to increase? Is it the upper level? Is it spread out evenly across?
Senator Dukes, it is pretty much spread out. Some of the service industries and the trade industries seem to pick up earlier, and some of those would be lower wage for sure. But as we look at graphs now, comparing where we are now to where we were a year ago, we're seeing about half of the manufacturing industries up from a year ago. And when I was giving speeches, for example, last March, I can distinctly remember that there were basically no manufacturing industries that had more jobs then than they did a year ago. So that it has improved across there. Construction seems to have hit bottom. In fact, I have a speech tomorrow, lunchtime, and just putting the graphs together for that. Manufacturing and construction both seem to have turned the corner. But things are still sluggish. And, of course, the public sector, which seemed to skate through the first year of the recession, now is facing its own challenges. So that's going to be another reason why the recovery will be slow. But it is across all industries. That's your question.
Oh, Senator. Yes, Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question directs to the opposite side of the equation, for Senator Carter's. Focusing on supply, my question is looking at demand for jobs. To what extent does your department and the wonderful resources that you have interface with our economic development department in developing some type of a unified strategy for promotion of the demand side of the equation?
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, I'll just talk from the research point of view, and our regional economists in particular do have ongoing contact with the regional development officers from economic development. I wouldn't maybe carry it, it varies by area. I don't know that there's an agency to agency kind of complete plan, although Debbie certainly may have a broader knowledge of that. But from the research point of view, we've been very much tied in when small or large companies move into areas. Again, the issue is like, will there be enough workers? And if so, how much are they going to want to get paid on average in this area? We get called in rural areas and in Portland. I mean, it's truly a statewide thing. Our folks over in La Grande are very much part of their efforts for the whole of Eastern Oregon to do that. But looking at the wages, the labor availability, and just trying to make sense sometimes of those comparing unemployment rates. What does that really mean for this metals company as opposed to what does that mean for a call center? Because the skills are very different, and we may not have the right people. So on a project-by-project basis, I think we're very tied in with those folks.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, at the state level, the Economic Development Department is a partner with all the workforce agencies. It sits on the Workforce Investment Board. I think over the last decade, they have been concentrating on community infrastructure more than on economic development. This governor has made it very, very clear that we're going to swing back to the economic development piece and that the workforce effort is going to support them. So I'm seeing us in the coming years being joined at the hip in terms of being part of the development of economic development plans and folding the workforce piece into that.
Thank you. That was exactly the direction I was hoping we were going.
Okay.
Senator Robson Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we had, and I'm trying to figure out quite how to phrase this, but how many jobs or what percentage are out there that are unfilled because we don't have trained people to fill them? Is that like 0.5% of the unemployment rate? Is it, if we've got an unemployment rate of 7, would that be 1% or 0.5%?
Okay, Madam Chair and Representative Hanson, let me take a couple stabs at that, and I could try to come back with
good
a percentage.
Guess.
Yeah,
well,
one of the answers that I think is very relevant is that during the boom years of the mid-90s, when unemployment rates in Oregon were very low and employers were just crying out, couldn't find enough workers, we still had 80,000 unemployed. And that always startled people, because with all those unemployed, how could we have such a labor shortage? So that's one measure. And then we did two employer surveys in 2000 and 2002, and we asked them how many jobs that they tried to fill and how many they'd been successful in filling. And the numbers from 2000, it was something like 828,000 jobs they tried to fill, just any kind of vacancy for any reason. And from memory, I think the number was 695,000 that they were able to. And I see Senator Carter writing that down, so I would want to confirm that before she uses her peripheral vision. But that tells you right there that employers had a very difficult time finding the right people. In the recession, we did the same thing, and the number of openings was way down, 828,000 to 576,000, which is still a big number when you think about it. And the percent that they were able to fill went from 82 to 86. Which still tells me that even in this time, there's just a lot of people out there unemployed, 120,000 now, who still aren't the right people, the right match, the right skills, or the right geographic area for the jobs. And that's the big underlying issue for Oregonians.
I can see two different issues floating there. For example, in healthcare, there's a real shortage of nurses and certified health professionals. And those are really good family wage jobs. Then there's also kind of the bottom level, too. There are some entry-level jobs that pay so little that people can't afford to work at them. And those are kind of two different problems. And I'm working much more concerned with the one of the family wage jobs that people don't qualify for, rather than the jobs that the employers can't fill because the salary structure is too low. Is there any kind of a differential between those two different types of jobs?
Can I respond? Okay, mm-hmm. Representative Johnson. Twice a year we do a study on the shortage occupations, And the low-wage ones are almost always on the list. You know, less so right now because people are more desperate, frankly, to take them. They were much more of an issue in the mid-90s. The healthcare ones that you've mentioned are always on the list. And then there's some other pretty high-skill ones. One would be some of the construction, trade contractor, the journey-level, highly-skilled people. And another one that's always almost impossible to fill is long-haul truck drivers, which also can be pretty decent wages, but, of course, the working conditions and the away-from-home stuff. Almost all across the state, we see those. A couple of interesting ones that have come up recently, and that is that it's hard to fill some lumber occupations. And you mentioned earlier about the people who have been out of the labor force or out of employment for 10 years. There's quite a few, even rural areas, in fact the South Coast is one, where it's very hard to find the lumber workers they need now because people have either retired or relocated or retrained. And so for a variety of those reasons, you can't even find those. But most of those occupations I've mentioned are at the higher levels, and you're right, then there's that completely separate group that is the kind of the low wage, and people just don't want to do those jobs. Although, again, right now, you kind of may have to because it's all that's available. You can't be quite as picky as people were in the late 90s.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I hated to bring 30 years of experience here, but at the same time, the information was anecdotal to you at first. But now, listening to an economist who has done the research, you can see the legitimacy of my frustration over the years. But it would appear to me, Mr. Chairman, in listening to this information that Graham is giving to us, is that if a person, and it's back to Representative Smith's comment, in stabilizing the revenue stream in the state, if a person is released from DOC or OIA and they are on probation, it would appear to me that these are the kind of areas that can be filled and make these people productive citizens of our society. It doesn't make sense to me for a person to be walking around on the street on probation, fulfilling nothing but taking valuable air. Excuse me, I mean death. But somewhere along the line, we're missing the mark in terms of that issue because we know that we throw away 5%. I hate to say that right. 5%, we keep 5% unemployment so that we won't have high levels of inflation across the country. But a lot more of the people can be working if we had the system in place that would say, back to your and Representative Smith's comments, if there is a preparatory stage for these people before they leave prison, mm-hmm. or there was something there to develop the life skills so that they can go right into the workforce. I mean, I think I'd rather have a $5.89 a job per hour job than to come out of prison with nothing in mind. And if we were tied those things to that kind of opportunity, we would be really helping to develop the individual instead of them just walking around on the street ready to commit another crime. So that's why I'm saying that a system needs to be in place for this kind of constructive engagement to take place. And if the Employment Division for years, which it has given us good information in terms of economic outlooks and also those developable jobs that have been developed and are ready for people to have, then something is wrong with our system that we are not using those people. Because I can't think of, and you can't make a person off the street do anything, but if they're under our supervision in terms of in terms of probation, we certainly can, that is a hook.
Senator, I think that's a great point because, you know, if you go and look at our system, say, well, is this punishment for the crime that was committed? Mm-hmm. That isn't what the Constitution says. So we're right. Supposed to be about rehabilitating.
Took
and
that out of the Constitution about 4 years ago.
Did we take it out? Yeah. Well, that shows how much attention I was paying. No, seriously. Mm-hmm. Well, see, you're not the only one that was having trouble this morning.
Okay. Thank you very much for your attention this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
let me ask a question. What are you guys back on your floor at 11?
Yeah, but I've got a meeting about 3 minutes ago.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to push forward. Deborah, how would it fit with you if the next presenter? What kind of time? You don't ask
sure.
a million questions.
Sure. We can bring the next person up and see how far we get.
Should we do it? Anyone who needs to leave, will go ahead and do that. If we need to go to a subcommittee, we'll do it.
Senator Morrison, do you have a question also?
When do you plan on adjourning?
Well, I figured about 15, Phil. Is that enough time?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Byerly is our Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance, and he will go into the measures for unemployment program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance, as Debbie indicated. I'm still in the new handout that we gave you this morning. We're on page 17 now, if you could turn there. Because unemployment insurance is a joint federal-state program, we are subject to 20 primary and over 50 secondary measures. We refer to those as UI performs. Our task in working with the Progress Board was to try to come up with as few measures as possible that would definitely demonstrate the outcomes that we think we need to show that we're serving our customers the best. And so there are six outcomes here in the next few pages. There are actually seven here. One of them relates to higher authority appeals, and I'll touch on that briefly. I don't have a whole lot of impact or control over that particular measure, but I'll talk about it briefly. All the UI measures were adopted by the review committee of the Oregon Progress Board. The first measure you see there is the first pay timeliness, and that's the percentage of unemployment insurance payments that are paid within 21 days of an individual filing the claim or being found eligible for benefits, that is. And you can see that our targets for the next few years are 90%. They have come down over the prior years, and we attribute that mostly to just pure workload. Unemployment, as you know, skyrocketed. I was just looking at some numbers. From the year 2000 to the year 2001, we had nearly 150,000 additional new or reopened claims. And then from 2001 to 2002, there was another 100,000 more new or reopened claims. So suffice it to say the workload has kind of put us a little bit behind the eight ball. We're scrambling to keep up. We hope to get the numbers back up, but that's where we are right now, and our target is 90%. The next measure is the non-monetary separation timeliness, and I just thought maybe I'd say for the record, what is non-monetary? That's any issue not related to an individual's money, in other words, the value of their claim. So non-monetary issues are things like their job separation, are they available for work, are they actively seeking work, those types of issues.
Excuse me, Senator Dukes, we're on page 17, the UI.
Thank you. So the first measure you see there at the bottom of page 17 is the percent of claims that relate to job separations that we adjudicate. We examine the eligibility within 21 days of the detection of the issue. And there again, our percentages are down. We're trying to get them back up, but it's part of the workload crush that we've been under. We could turn the page to page 18. The top of the page are the non-monetary, non-separation timeliness measure. Non-separation issues are, again, issues related to an individual availability for work. Are they actively seeking work? Those types of things. Are they within the labor market that where they're seeking work? And, again, our percentages are down a little bit in this area. It's of course, again, workload related. Our goals, you can see, our targets for the next few years are going to go up. We are looking at lots of ways to streamline the work for our staff. We've instituted more automated letters and things in our computer system on individual PCs so we can try to improve the timeliness and the quality of that type of work.
Tom, relative to that, is that a question that's asked if someone comes in to apply? Do you have a computer? Are you online? That sort of stuff. I mean, is it possible for us to interact with a lot of them without them actually coming to the office?
Mr. Chair, we are looking at lots of ways to do that, and we do ask individuals. We ask right on the application if they have an email address, so we can correspond to them via email. We allow individuals now to file their weekly claim on the internet. In fact, 37% of our customers file their weekly claim using the internet now. And the beauty of that is you can do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You don't get kicked off. You can examine your answers as you fill them out. You can do it at your leisure, and it's very helpful. we want to also offer that service soon for employers. And rather than send them all this paper that they can respond to, we want to put a website out there where they can check their claims that are filed against them and respond electronically. So, yeah, the access issue is really key to us, and we think it can make, help our efficiencies as well as make the customers get a better product in the end.
If a person went to one of the kiosks, can it respond that way also, or do you need to go to like to a library if you don't have a computer and use their web connection?
I think you can file your weekly claim on the kiosk. You couldn't probably respond via email on the kiosk.
Yes.
They're shaking their head yes.
Yeah, we haven't set up the kiosk so you can correspond with us yet, but you can file your weekly claim. You bet. The measure at the bottom of the page are our non-monetary determination of quality. This is all of the decisions that we issue relating to an individual's eligibility. This is an area where we really are stressing the need to improve, and hopefully with our automated tools we're providing our staff that we'll get we'll raise that measure very soon.
So just a question, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Sandra Carter.
So why did we see it peak in 01 since it's the determination status?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, which measure are you looking at, please?
Looking at 2001 non-monetary determinations, quality.
Quality.
Mm-hmm.
It peaked in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And
no, it peaked in 2001. It spiked in 2000.
Quality went up in 2000. It came down in 2001.
Right.
And that was related to, again, our workload just increased dramatically from 2000 to 2001 with the recession.
So you're seeing more people accessing the system as a result of job loss?
That's correct.
Okay.
As I indicated earlier, it was approximately 150,000 new or reopened claims versus from 2000 to 2001. So there's a substantial workload increase.
And then 100,000.
100,000 approximately from 2001 to 2002. Okay. We can move on. Page 19. At the top are the higher authority timeliness graphs that I indicated that we personally don't have a lot of control over. We do try to help the higher authority people get their documents as quick as possible so they can hold the reviews of the cases. Tom Ewing, our chief hearing officer, will be up later to discuss the lower level appeals from the hearing officer panel. The bottom of page 19 is our employer tax report timeliness. And you can see our numbers are substantially below what our targets are hoping for in the coming years. We don't have our numbers in for 2000 all just yet, but we're shooting for 90% timeliness on employer tax reports. And part of the reason that we think we can get there is we are providing lots more access for employers electronically. We have our auto program where we can send a disk out. Diskette out to employers that has a software they can fill out the reports and send them back to us electronically. In fact, that system won us a Compass Award for innovation for our national association, which Debbie is a member in 2001. We also have electronic means. If you're an employer that doesn't have any payroll for a particular quarter, you can call in on our telephone system and just report that you had no income for those period. So the electronic means, again, access 24/7, 365 days a year. We think we can get our timeliness up on that area.
Graham, do you think that decreases because folks are, they're under financial stress, possibly cutting staff in the office, and they're just getting behind because they may not have it or don't have the means to prepare it on time, or any analysis that way?
Mr. Chair, I don't have any analysis on that. I can ask staff when I get back today and ask them if there's some reasons that we have seen about that, and I'll report back tomorrow. That's okay. Turning the page to page 20. This is just the tax payments timeliness for employers. And this continues to go up. And again, we think it's relatively due to our automation of our tax reporting systems. We're at 94.5 for 2001, and our target is 95% for the coming years.
Wow.
So that's really come a long way. As you can see, it jumped pretty good from 2000 to 2001. At the bottom of the page, we made some brief comparisons from the states of Washington, Idaho, and then the United States as a whole, with the Oregon program for unemployment insurance. And the data we have here, again, is as Jan indicated earlier, is collected by the U.S. Department of Labor. Unfortunately, it is for calendar year 2001, because while our numbers are probably available for 2002, most other states we couldn't get access to. So for means of comparison, we just used 2001. It's interesting that when I was reviewing these, that the United States average duration is 13.5, and that Oregon is just right real close to the average for the entire country. You see the weekly benefit amount comparisons down there. Washington is the highest in the region, and for 2001, we were at $88 minimum and $376 maximum.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah. Senator Dukes.
Okay, here's my sheer stupidity. Why is Washington so much higher?
Yeah.
I mean, is the state putting money into this to boost it up higher?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, this would be it's done by law, and I'm not sure exactly why their benefit amount is higher than ours.
Federal or state law?
It'd be state law. It's state law that determines. States control their weekly benefit amounts. That's correct.
Okay.
In Oregon, ours is 1.25% of the average weekly wage, and I'm not sure what the state of Washington is.
That was my question. Are they losing more high-paid people?
Mr. Chair, I'm not an economist, but my supposition would be that probably is true because of the Boeings and the Microsofts and people like that have shut down up north. Graham, I don't know if you've looked at Washington at all.
I don't know.
When I look at the number of claims across America, there were 21 million. Do we still, I remember under President Reagan, we used data from the military department to determine employment versus unemployment. Do we still use those numbers for those that are employed? Is that why this number so high, or recessionary activity across the country reflects this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I'm not sure of the answer to that, but I can find out.
I should have asked Graham. You're right, while he was up here.
I apologize.
That's perfectly okay, because I'm asking questions outside of your category, but it was just interesting that I saw those numbers, because, Mr. Chairman, again, if we are using military statistics, it doesn't really, really reflect the high unemployment that Oregon has, because we are using numbers that includes those that are in the military as opposed to ordinary citizens who are unemployed.
I'm watching the clock here, and I promised this committee we would shut down, so if it's okay with you, we will resume again tomorrow.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Very good. We thank you for this presentation and for helping us to understand this subject, and as you can see, a lot of interest by the committee. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5516, and we'll see you all tomorrow.